Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
I'm at the table with the cartel guy, and he just keeps looking at me with this weird look in his face. I'm sitting there thinking, I don't think this guy's buying this story at all. He stops me and he says, Jeffrey, you don't look like a millionaire. He starts to kind of bow up on me like, I think this is a con job. I decide best defense sometimes is a strong offense. So I stand up in the bar and I said, deal's off. And he says, well, what is the problem? You know, the typical walk away negotiation. I said, look, you look really nice with your little Rolex and your cool little mesh looking shoes with no socks. But you know what you look like to me? You look like a doper. So when I'm not showing you my airplane, because the minute I do, they're going to know what we're doing. They're going to seize my $1 million airplane. So it's been nice talking to you. And then I basically told him to F off.
I'm Steve Murphy, DEA special agent retired and now host of the Game of Crimes podcast. If you've seen the Netflix series Narcos, then you know my story. I now bring you stories of heroism and bravery from our law enforcement and military heroes, and occasionally from the criminals that they faced. Welcome to Game of Crimes. Guys, you're not going to believe today's guest. First of all, welcome back to this week's episode of Game of Crimes. I'm already drying tears out of my eyes from laughing so much. Today is going to be a lot of fun. And I'm not real sure what we're going to talk about just yet. I don't know what's going to come out of this guy's mouth. He's one of the funniest people I ever met. And we're talking to a 30-year veteran of law enforcement who spent his last 26 years as a special agent with the Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA. And I put this little sign up here just so you guys wouldn't forget the lettering. DEA, right? Don't expect anything. I'm sorry. Drunk every afternoon. I'm sorry. Drug Enforcement Administration. I'll get it right. Don't even ask. Okay. But I tell you what, it's my true honor and pleasure to welcome today's guest, Jeff Sweeten. Jeff, welcome to the show, brother.
Thanks, Steve.
You say that now. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. Hey, you can't do any worse than it's already been done to me. So don't worry about it.
Yeah. All those years in the government, it's kind of hard to sit down sometimes, isn't it?
That's true.
So everybody, we're going back to the small town police blotter because this is the right guy to be reading the story. I'm not going to tell you where he lives, but he's currently in Florida. He doesn't live here. He's like me. He's a snowbird, although I do live in Florida. So you're going to get two stories from Florida today. But to get the disclaimer out there first, you guys know this is a story about crime. This is a story where we talk about bad people. We talk about bad people doing bad things to good people. Now, we're going to take some of what we talk about today serious because we're going to have a lot of fun, but we never want to miss the opportunity to have a nice little laugh at the expense of some of these idiots out here who should have chosen a different career path other than being a criminal. So, Jeff, I'm going to let you start off, brother. A story from Florida, please.
Great. Well, thanks, Steve. Okay. A Florida man wanted by the cops tried to throw them off his trail by placing a big sign outside his house reading, "Johnny Yates does not live here." It didn't work. Yates, 41, who was wanted by the Polk County Sheriff's Office on aggravated battery, false imprisonment and tampering charges, was eventually locked up. Deputies showed up at Yates' Lakewood home at around 2:45 p.m., or Lakeland, rather, after getting a tip that he was holed up inside. When the deputies arrived, they noticed a note written on a dry erase board in front of a window that said, "Johnny Yates does not live here." Gee, a dry erase board never lied to us before. Should we believe it?
Yeah.
The deputies questioned someone leaving the house, who confirmed that Yates was inside. But after surrounding the house for an hour and calling for the fugitive to come out, cops had to take it to the next level. Bad things usually happen when you read that line.
Oh, take it to
the next level, especially in Polk County. Enough was enough, and the surrender smoke was dispensed inside the house, and four people exited the home, but no Johnny. Deputies called out some more, but still no response from Johnny. So a second helping of surrender smoke was put inside the home to waft around a bit. Still no response from Johnny. Finally, deputies and K-9 Dexter entered the house and located Johnny, who was hiding in a modified chest of drawers. So if K-9s can't read, that was not a great part of Johnny's plan. Johnny was arrested and taken to jail. The office said the four people who were initially holed up in the house with Yates were also dealt with. In regards to the four people who weren't cooperating with deputies, each one received a parting gift, a charge of resisting, and an all-expense-paid trip to Grady Judd's Bed and Breakfast. Old County Sheriff Grady Judd, that is. He's class.
Oh, yeah, man. That's the guy that I'm trying my best. In fact, do you remember Mike Stokes on the job?
I do. Yeah, I worked with Mike.
Yeah, so Mike's up in Tennessee now. He called me. I was in the DEA Academy here just a few weeks ago with a New England college out of New Hampshire. They go every year and get a tour of the academy and spend the day and all that. There's a lady in there in diversion, Heather. I won't give Heather's last name, but she found out I was interested in Grady. She called Mike. Mike's like, I'll call him right now. So I'm just waiting to hear back, hoping to get Grady Judd on the show here. If you're listening, Grady, we'd love to have you, brother.
Yeah, that'd be fun. He's excellent. I email him sometimes. He doesn't really know me. I'm pretty sure that he's going to have me charged with stalking because every time I see him post something, I email him and thank him for what he does, but also for just putting a little humor into a job that sorely needs it.
Absolutely. Man, and he is beloved unbelievably over in Polk County. Nobody,
I'm sure he's struggling with his elections, yeah.
All right, man. I had used that story once before. I've got a Patreon subscriber channel, patreon.com/gameofcrimes. And one of the sessions is you can't make this crap up. That's every month, and it's an hour's worth of stupid criminals from around the world. And I thought, man, that story that you just read is perfect for you.
No question. No question.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. Listen, we're going to go into the next story here from Florida. You guys may have heard this before if you're on Patreon. If you haven't, you should come over and check us out. So it's tough out there for a salesman. Sometimes you have to make cold calls, and that's exactly what this teenage salesman, and we can say his name because he was tried as an adult, Shaquille McKinney did. Just that the product he was marketing to potential customers was Jeff's favorite, cannabis. Yep. McKinney made a number of cold calls throughout the Pinellas County area in Florida asking people if they wanted some of the green stuff. Unfortunately, this rocket scientist, one of the people, was a Gulfport police detective who arranged to meet McKinney at a nearby school. And when the young boy arrived to deliver the drugs, he found a number of officers waiting for him. He was charged with drug possession with intent to distribute within 1,000 feet of a school. So here's a young man who at a very young age got to meet law enforcement and now has an opportunity to turn his life around once he gets out of jail, because the life as a drug dealer, it ain't gonna work for him.
Beautiful.
Idiots.
I bet you he made his commission number though.
You can tell you're in private industry now talking about that.
Yeah exactly. Exactly.
Well, everybody listen, you know, I always talk about how we met and I've been racking my brain, Jeff. I think we met when you were in headquarters and I was out in probably SOD at the time.
I think that's right. I was trying to think that too. And I look at your book and you and Javier's book about all the real stuff you did during your career. And I know I couldn't have been a part of any of that. So it must have been during an administrative assignment between my assignment as the Xerox guy and the guy that cleaned Joe Keefe's windows. But yeah, I think it must have been at headquarters, but it's been a great friendship ever since.
Oh yeah, man. It's hilarious. And Joe Keefe, man, you talk about a legend. We all talk about who's your rabbi. Joe Keefe was my rabbi.
No question. Best guy, best, smartest, sharpest, funniest guy I ever worked for. And I think people along the way you work for like that change your life. And he certainly changed mine. And some of it, I hope we have a chance to get to on some of the stunts that I pulled at headquarters to try to make my day easier that potentially backfired on me because I worked for Joe Keefe too. It was just way too smart to try to pull one over on.
Oh, well, I got to tell you one quick story. You remember Keith Bishop?
I do, yeah.
Keith was a real prankster, as you know. And for those of you that don't know Keith Bishop, go look up the Denver Broncos. He played 8 years with them, was all pro. Big man, got the biggest hands of any man I ever met in my life. But when we were Special Operations Division out the new building in Chantilly, Keith, I mean, he didn't care who you were. And Joe was our special agent charge at the time. Heaven forbid you leave your laptop or your desktop computer unlocked when you walk away from your desk, because he walked by the boss's office one day, saw Joe's computer on, and went and started sending love letters to different people from Joe Keefe. It didn't take Joe long to figure out who it was, though.
Yeah.
I love the guy. Love both those guys.
He's great. One of the greatest, and we can get to it later, but one of the greatest pranks I ever played on Joe Keefe was in the hours following 9/11, and we were in desperate need of a laugh because of our proximity to the Flight 77 crash. And I look back now and I think it probably was way too soon, but we needed a laugh at the expense of the FBI, and you don't miss that opportunity. So,
are you going to tell us what it was?
I'll be happy to. I'll give you the quick version. So, after Flight 77 flew towards my office window and crashed into the Pentagon. It was obviously bedlam for several hours after that, but eventually the FBI came over as part of their pent bomb investigation and wanted to interview witnesses. And my first thought was airplane in the air, airplane in the Pentagon. I don't know what we're going to talk about. So we decided to have some fun. So, this tiny, probably 4'5" female FBI agent was assigned with her partner to interview us. And these are the most important people in DEA. And then there's horse holders like us that were their admin assistants.
Right.
And during this, they get ready to interview us one at a time. And her partner leaves her, says, "This is not going anywhere well. I don't want to be a part of this." So she's by herself. So Larry Galina, who was then the chief of domestic operations, volunteered. He's like a grandpa figure. He volunteered to be her first witness. And he was in there like an hour. And so I said, "I'd like to go next." So when I was interviewed, I said, "Listen, this is kind of difficult to talk about, but you just talked to Larry Galina for an hour." And I said, "I don't know what he could have told you, but the whole thing lasted about 10 seconds. And I said, "I don't know what Larry says he saw, but as soon as we saw the plane, Larry peed his pants, got under my desk and hid there in a fetal position. And we had to carry him out. So he couldn't have seen anything." So we all had a big laugh. And then, so I went in to be interviewed next, and I explained that to her, and she says, "Oh dear, that's so sad." I said, "There's another thing that I have to tell you, and it's about Joe Keefe. He's going to be coming in next. Very big deal, very important man. But I said, he's going to tell you what he thinks he saw. But I said, I have to warn you, as his XO, his depth perception's terrible." And she said, "Oh, really? Why is that?" I said, "Well, he has a glass eye." I said, "He's missing one of his eyes." And I said, "So it gives him no depth perception." And I said, "And he's really kind of, he has a really bad temper. And I said, if you look into his glass eye too long, he'll call you on it. So when you're interviewing him, don't take his report seriously because he has no idea, but don't look into his glass eye." So she thanked me profusely. And as I walked out, she said, "Agent Sweeten, which eye is glass?" And I said, "That's the problem. We don't know." So Joe Keefe had been in there about 5 minutes when I realized Joe's smart enough to know that he's been set up. So as he walked out, I heard something I heard a lot, which was him pointing at me saying, "My office." So when I had to break it to him, he said, "What did you do?" She wouldn't look at me. She was like shaking. I said, "I just said glass eye." And he just shook his head. And he often said, "Some squad. This is some squad I have here." So.
Oh my gosh, that's hilarious.
A great man, and I think he has two eyes. So,
oh, I love that guy.
He's great.
He was a true visionary, in my opinion. So.
Yeah, even with one eye, he was a partial visionary in mine. But no question. And people used to come in and try to fool him and make up stories. And we'd say, "Look, whatever you do, don't lie to this guy, because he's not asking you a question he doesn't already know the answer to." And people tried it and perished. They were never seen again. But it was fun to watch. It was super fun to watch.
Yep. Yep. But you were serious about that part.
No question.
All right. So, Joe, if you're listening, brother, we miss you. We had some good times.
Joe, sorry. Hope the vision thing works itself out, Joe.
He called. Well, I got to tell you one story. I was an ASAC in Atlanta. No, I was a GS in Atlanta. I had the mobile enforcement team. And one of the other enforcement groups got in a shooting. And it was 5 o'clock. Secretaries went home, and you knew headquarters was going to be calling. So I went up and just manned the secretarial phones while John Andraker was our SAC at the time. You knew everybody was going to be calling. And sure enough, Joe Keefe calls, and I recognized his voice. He said, "I'll speak to Mr. Andraker, please." And I said, "Who the hell is this, and who do you think you're calling?" He said, "Excuse me?" I said, "Why do you want to talk to John Andraker? Who do you think you are? Are you the press?" And he's like, "Is this Murph?" I'm like, well, damn, that didn't last forever.
Busted. Yeah, that's pretty good. Only Joe wouldn't be able to do that. So. Yeah. Yeah, there's several chapters of a book on Joe Keefe. One other quick one was and this is probably the statute of limitations has run, but Jimmy Capra and I were horse holders for Keefe. And in order to get through the amount of paperwork, which it was about 3 to 4 feet of paperwork a day those guys had to deal with, we would handle their paperwork and try to cull out what was most important for the end of the day.
Right.
And one day we're at a meeting and it's a meeting to change relocation privileges for agents. It was an important deal. And all these policies, preliminary policies had come out, and Mr. Keefe had joined, Joe Keefe had joined this meeting, and Jimmy Capra and I are sitting at the back wall. Joe knew he had somebody, and you knew the way he was talking that he knew he had him. And he was always kind to people, but he was great at calling them out. And finally he said, "I'm the chief of operations. Who signed that policy? Because I think that's my job to sign that policy." And they held the paper up and they said, "You did, Mr. Keefe." And I had signed his name to that memo without a really thorough meeting, which we had to do. So he looked at it and he says, "Oh, yeah, I guess I did." And I was behind him. And so he's looking over his shoulder for me and I'm hiding. I'm trying to hide. So the meeting ends and me and Capra take off. We basically just run. And he steps out of the office and I hear again, "My office." We had to explain to him why we signed his name all day, but too smart to put one over. He had the wrong squad for sure up there.
Well, Dan, Jimmy Capra is a legend himself and has been
true
on
legend.
The show. He's been on the show as well. So, all right. So let's get into your background a little bit here. If you don't mind, tell us a little bit about where you grew up, your family dynamics. Did you play sports, brothers and sisters, schools, college, all that kind of stuff?
Sure. So I won't go into too much detail about the early years because I don't remember them. But I was born. My dad was with the space program in Melbourne, at the Cape. So I was born I was born just outside the Cape, and then my dad was on tracking ships, so he didn't want to be on ships. So he told his boss, and this I learned this career tactic from my dad. He told his boss, "I'm going out on ship, but I'm tired of being away from my family. It was just me and my brother and my mom." He said, "Put me in for any job in the company." And he was a contractor through RCA. "Put me in for any job in the company where I can be home at night with my family." So he gets back from a float and his boss is waiting for him at the dock. And he says, "Mo, I got good news and I got bad news." He said, "Good news is you're going to be home with your family every night." My dad said, "Thanks," and started to walk off. And he said, "Well, don't you want to know where you're going?" He goes, "Not really." He goes, "Okay, I'll bite. Where am I going?" He says, "Fairbanks, Alaska."
Ouch.
So we jumped in the car and drove to Fairbanks, Alaska for a couple of years and eventually ended up in Maryland. So I grew up in Maryland. My dad was at Goddard Space Flight Center. And as a result, I had an idyllic upbringing in Bowie, Maryland. If those people that know anything about Bowie, Maryland, it was a massive Levitt community. There was no upper class. We all lived, our families all lived within $5,000 a year of each other. So it was thousands and thousands of kids our age. So, 1,000 kids in my high school graduating class. So it was really a great place to grow up. Had an uncle who was a BNDD, which one of the precursor agencies to DEA, heard a lot of his stories through the years and really became interested in being a federal agent. So went to college at Towson University. First girl I met there, I eventually married, who's my favorite first wife. She's still my current wife. And she made the whole rest of the story possible, but majored in a couple things, ended up, did an internship at the Maryland State Penitentiary because a lot of the teachers at the time were trying to steer law enforcement guys into corrections, into the treatment side. And so after about one semester of interviewing guys on death row, I realized that all the people I met in prison needed to be in prison. I didn't meet a single guy who I thought, what a harsh thing this guy's in prison for. So I stayed on the criminal justice side and graduated and became a cop in Arlington, Virginia. And I applied at every police department around the city. Arlington hired me and they were the highest paying at the time. So I chased the money. I was a cop chasing the money, and that was a fabulous police department, just a phenomenal place to start. So I ended up going with DA after about 4 years. But in 4 years, I got to work old clothes. I was a SWAT collateral guy. So it was an amazing 4 years of experience that I got there. And the next thing you know, old Jed's a millionaire. I turn up one day. I'm getting hired as a DEA agent. And about 6 months later, I'm in jungle school in Panama, walking through some river, and just stopped. And I thought, what am I doing here? And I had that thought several times throughout my career, but it always ended up to be just an incredible blessing. And I often say I would have paid the DEA to let me do what they paid me to do.
Yep. Well, I want to back up just a little bit here. Now, you have two sons, right? Are either of them in law enforcement?
Yeah, both of them have had at least a case of law enforcement. My oldest son is a HSI agent. He's a prior cop in Boulder, Colorado, and Denver, Colorado. With what's happened in policing, he made his way to the federal agents. So he's an HSI and currently assigned, like these poor HSI guys are, assigned somewhere other than their home every week. So he's on his second 30-day stint in Minneapolis and did some time in Memphis. And it's hard on these guys. You know, I'm not serious very much, but I don't know how long I could have taken being gone. And then, you know, they're going to have to do FIFA and they're going to have to do augment Secret Service. So these are tough times for those guys. And I think, you know, I talked to some TSA guys too, that are working without money. And so that's my oldest, and he's great. We got two grandkids with him and his wonderful wife. And then my other son was a Marine Corps ROTC officer who ended up a captain in Iraq. Soon after he came back from Iraq, he went to work with the Bureau, with the FBI. Did that for about a year, and basically told me something, showed some courage that I don't think I would have had. And he just said, listen, Dad, I'm leaving. I'm not going to chase January 6th guys my whole career, which is what he had been doing. So he left and went to work for Chick-fil-A Corporation, where he is today. And he is having a phenomenal life and career in the private sector, in the chicken industry. Is a phenomenal kid. He's got four young kids. So we have four grandbabies there. And he had a great career as a Marine Corps captain and probably would have stayed in if the deployment tempo wasn't what it was.
Yeah.
So really proud of both of them. They're great boys.
Absolutely. And thankfully he had the brain at a young age to realize that's not what he wanted to do, rather than being miserable for sure his life.
Yeah. I'm not sure I could have had that kind of courage at that age to walk away from the Bureau, because you do, you know, in all these jobs, there's a risk of getting handcuffed by your retirement and your benefits. And he didn't. And it has paid huge dividends for him.
Well, do his business cards on the back of it, you get a free Chick-fil-A sandwich?
Absolutely, they do. And there's different ones. It's sad because he gets a box of them about every month. And whenever we go through there, his mom takes pretty much most of them. And some of them are, you know, some of them are desserts. Some of them are chicken fingers, chicken tenders. So yeah, we tell him we forgot who he is and we need more business cards.
I love it. And just a shout out to your wife there. I mean, you were giving her some props there. I refer to our families as our unsung heroes, because they keep the home fires burning. They put up with everything while you and I are out doing what we think is important. We feel like we're helping the public. We certainly, and in all honesty, we did. Most people won't agree with that, but our family, our wives, our significant others, God bless them.
Well, I agree. One of the things I loved about Narcos, I didn't like the fact that all of my bravery was left out of it and my courage. But one of the things I loved about that is how they portrayed your wife. And it was, I'm sure it was Hollywoodized, kind of like you having nice hair. It just was a lot of that's, you know, added, but it really portrayed, I think, to a certain extent, how the real difficulty it is being married to people like us. And, I look at what my wife's gone through, and now I look at what my son, you know, his wife is going through. And we all, you know, we talk about my first year on the job, I was gone over 280 days that year. So we get married, we pick up, we're both in DC where we grew up, and we get sent to Florida. And, I check her into our apartment and said, I got to be gone for a little bit. And I was gone as part of SnowCap and that program. So she talks about how she cried for a couple of days, probably because she had married me, probably had nothing to do with me being gone. But she went door to door in our apartment building saying, I'm your neighbor and I don't have any friends. And I'm looking for friends. And one girl invited her to church, and we're strong believers. And that was it. So she was off and running. So I came home after that year and she said, you need to come out and meet our friends now. So, but it was really It was really, and not only that, it was a bizarre time, right? So we had a house built. Our first house was built in Boca Raton, which really wasn't Boca Raton. New agents couldn't afford to live in the Boca Raton. It was really the Everglades that still had the Boca Raton address. And we would go and visit our home we were building, and we'd visit it like every night. We had nothing else to do. We had no kids yet. So we were visiting it, and we met the neighbors next door, and they were the kindest, most sweetest people from Tennessee. And so they met us outside. So he brought us over to meet his wife. And I was working an undercover deal at the time where I carried the big brick cell phone, and the guys in Colombia would call me, and they spoke pretty good English. And, you know, so between my Spanish and their English, we would negotiate this transportation deal we were doing. So we go over to their house, and they're giving us a tour of their house, and my cell phone starts buzzing, and I see it's a Colombian number. So they're out looking at the lake behind the house, and I look around, there's nobody around. And so I answer the phone, and it's this bad guy I'm working, and we're getting ready to do a couple hundred keys for him. So we start talking, and I fall into doper mode. And I'm dropping F-bombs. I don't talk like that when I'm not working, but I'm dropping F-bombs. I'm talking about, we'll chainsaw your head off if you try to rip us off. Unbeknownst to me, the wife of the couple had come back inside and was standing about 3 feet from me. And as I'm finishing up this call, I walk around the corner, and she is pale. So here she's got this nice couple moving next door. It's South Florida, so every other person's a doper. Uh-huh. And we're talking about, don't kill me, I won't kill you. And she is pale, and she looks like she's going to faint. So I got to clean this up, because I had told her I was in banking or something. So I said, go get your husband. So she thinks I'm going to chainsaw him, that I'm go get your husband, we're going to kill him. So my cover, my elaborate cover of being a banker lasted about a half an hour into my new neighborhood. So those are the kind of things that the wives of DEA agents and the husbands of female agents have to deal with on a daily basis. So her interview would be a lot more fun than mine. So.
That's hilarious. You know, when we came back from, and thank you for saying that about my wife, because she, if you remember the part in Narcos where she took the baby and went back to Miami, that never happened. And so they would send us, when they'd write an episode, they'd send us a script. And because she's portrayed, she'd get to read it and have input. She read that. She's came in shaking that thing. You know, I never left you. I've always stood by your side. And I'm like, baby, I didn't write it. So it was a couple weeks later, I'm on the phone with the executive producer. And she said, is that Eric? Let me talk to him.
Yeah. Eric learned a little bit about the agent's wife on that call, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. And then when we came back, when we transferred back from Columbia, we got stationed in Greensboro, North Carolina. And our real estate agents found us a nice house. We had the girls in. They were toddlers. Found us a nice house on a cul-de-sac. And when we first moved in, our neighbors, none of them would talk to us. They were all staying away from us. And finally, our best friends, and they're still some of our best friends today, they said, when the realtor was here one day, when you guys look at the house, we ask them who's moving in. And she says, all I can tell you is they're moving here from Columbia, South America, and he's involved in the drug business.
Very nice. Very good.
Talking about a setup, right?
That's perfect. Well, sometimes, you know, your best efforts to try to handle that. We didn't tell our neighbors in South Florida when we went back there. We were there a second time. We didn't tell any of them what we did. And I got a call that they needed to upgrade my background from whoever was doing it. I think it was a contractor. And he said, is there anybody in your neighborhood that doesn't know what you do? I said, none of them know what I do. I said, I have a money laundering target on my street. I said, so don't tell. Oh, we won't. Thank you. That's why we called. We just wanted to make sure. So we'll do this without ruining your deep cover in your neighborhood in Coral Springs, Florida. So I get home a couple of nights later, and there's four of my neighbors standing on my curb. And I'm like, oh, something must have happened. So I pulled up and I said, hey guys, is everything okay? And they said, we didn't know you work for DEA. The contractors had told every single one of my neighbors what I did. So I went in and Donna said, what was that all about? I said, I think they missed me. They wanted to talk to me. So we didn't stay very long after that. Not that I was some deep cover in danger guy like you guys were overseas, but I thought no matter what you try to do, it's not like TV, right? We didn't have really good cover protection. So it was just kind of wing it and hope. Right?
Oh yeah. Back then there was no such thing as backstopping.
Nope. Nothing.
Well, let me ask you, when you went through the, first of all, at Arlington County Police Department, so you were on patrol, you mentioned SWAT, plain clothes. I love it. You said old clothes. That's plain clothes.
Old clothes. Yeah. We were a tactical unit, so they wouldn't let us investigate anything because we would break it. But at Arlington, it was called the tactical squad, even though it was different than SWAT. And we would drive old cars, wear old clothes, let our hair grow, and basically do all the surveillances for the agency. And also, we would just go out and look for crime. It was the most fun policing assignment in the world. We'd drive around and you could find crime because you blended in. And I actually delivered pizzas for Domino Pizza for about 3 months trying to get robbed, which I later looked back and thought, they chose me because I was expendable. That's not because I was a great undercover guy. And I looked young. I looked like a high school kid. So we had had a robber that was robbing people with a sawed-off shotgun, robbing these pizza delivery guys. And so my boss, he was looking at solutions, and he was a brilliant boss at Crime Trends. He knew where to put us to catch criminals. So he came to me and he voluntold me that I was going to be working on this assignment. And it was the most jinky, gypsied out assignment ever. So I had a Domino's shirt on. I had a pickup truck with the light on top. And I would take all the calls that when they'd order pizza and they'd immediately call them back, that either nobody answered or the phone was out of service. And it was in a really bad area of the city or of the county. So I would take all those. And the tips weren't necessarily that great in that area anyway. So the drivers loved us. So my whole team that covered me ate free pizza for 3 months. And here I am out trying to get myself killed. So here was the plan. Think this plan through. If this is you. So you're delivering the pizzas. You're wearing a wire. And that wire, there's a code word, which probably was, hey, please don't rob me and kill me. Whatever the code word was. My partner was laying in the back of the truck under a tarp with an earphone, listening to my wire and a shotgun. So if I'm getting robbed, I say this code word. He sits up and If he needs to start shooting, he starts shooting, and hopefully I don't die. So we were comfortable with that plan for about 3 months, and they ended up capturing the guy somewhere else. So I didn't get killed, but I always felt like Domino's Pizza owed me some pizza.
Well, you ate free for 3 months. That's pretty good.
Yeah, and they all gained weight, and they're all in terrible shape anyway. I thought. But interestingly, whatever tips I made, I would take it back, and they'd split it up among the drivers. So we were the most popular cops that Domino's Pizza guys ever did. So, but another deep cover assignment for Jeff Sweeten, right?
There you go. So what led you to come to go from being a real uniform cop to wanting to go federal and go with DEA?
I always kind of wanted to go federal. I knew it wasn't really going to happen right out of college. I had this sense that as we were talking before the show about being real cops, I had a sense that I needed to understand policing at its most basic level. That you know, and you can do it. Guys have done it successfully. We call them FEOs or federal experience only. A lot of guys did great with that. But I felt like for me, I needed to understand policing at its most basic form. And I really wanted to see it. I wanted to experience it because I'm kind of a dummy when it comes to adventure. If I see something out there, like I don't like to watch sports as much as I like to just be in them. So it was a great time for me. And very quickly, I learned that uniform policing was different than what I thought. It was different than TV. It was dealing with drunks and crazy people. And so I learned it, but I felt like I needed to learn it. And I think when I went to DEA a little over 4 years later, I was more prepared for where I was going to because I knew what it looked like. And I think throughout my career, my appreciation for real cops really was super high and continued to grow because I knew what they were dealing with. And I'm glad I did that, but I was kind of simple-minded. You know, if you whatever you assign me to, I got to go figure it out from the ground level. I'm not a smart guy. I need to experience it. So,
well, so when you get to the academy now, during your academy days, did you ever have to write a memo for anything you did?
I did. Yeah. I'll say little trouble. I never got in big trouble. I had to write a memo for a couple of the biggies that were probably close to costing me lose my job. Like I leaned on the wall one time. We were all standing outside of class and I was tired. So I leaned on the wall. I think one time I put hands in my pockets when we were walking around. That was a no-no. And one time And I'm kind of embarrassed about this one. I later took over the academy and I had a lot of people write memos just for spite.
Payback.
I, I had to do it once because a couple of my dresser drawers were left open about a half an inch. So it was a great system of teaching you. You know what? You don't have to agree with it. Just do it. It's the highway system. It's my way or the highway. So, but nothing major. And there were some people in my class that had gotten into big trouble with, because of their residence proximity to female FBI trainees at the academy. And we'll just leave it at that. Some ended up in marriages. Some ended up destroying marriages. So, so some of them had to write different kind of memos. They needed attorneys and all that. But, most of my memos were just kind of get your attention memos.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, I had to do that too. But we're talking about you, not me today.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that in your book, Steve? I don't remember seeing that.
No, maybe the fine print. I'm not sure. Maybe a footnote. I don't remember.
Right.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
So what was your wish list? Where did you want to be stationed?
Well, I had an advantage in that. And it's DEA and most law enforcement. It's all about rabbis and who you know and kind of your network throughout the agency. And I had gotten, because of my proximity to DEA headquarters, I was an Arlington policeman and I lived in Arlington. I was an easy commute to DEA headquarters, if there's an easy commute, back when DEA headquarters was in downtown DC on I Street. So like the airlines do, DEA overbooked classes. They were trying to push as many people through classes as they could. So they would overbook a class by, say, five people. They'd give you an offer letter, say, this is a class you're slated for. Some of the guys that were hired at the same time and me, Sean McDonough, some of those guys were cops, guys I was cops with. But because they had overhired and they actually showed up, because they would hire people, four or five people would never show up, which I'd never got. They would say, okay, we've overhired. You're going to work at headquarters to start. And then when the next class starts, you're going to start up with that class. So you were basically, you didn't make the standby list in an airplane. So when I went to headquarters, they assigned me to agent recruitment. So I hired some of the guys I ended up working with.
Really?
So I would talk to them and they'd ask about their package and it was a complete dumpster fire. The way they were filing everything, there were packages that had been there 5 years, nobody had ever looked at. So we kind of organized that, being an OCD guy. But a lot of the people that met me said at my class said, your name sounds familiar. I said, yeah, I hired you. So, and I had worked for the agency. I was a GS-7, which was as low as they could possibly pay you. Here I am hiring people that I ended up working with. So I kind of had an idea. We were also worked with agent assignment. They knew me. So I thought, man, I may have a chance. Maybe they'll recognize my name. So even though I was from DC, I didn't request to stay at home. I was one of those rare people. I wanted to do something different. I wanted to go where, like I say, where the most basic level of drugs were. So I think Fort Lauderdale was my first choice. And then maybe like Atlanta, they were busy. They were relatively warm because I was tired of directing traffic and ice storms. And I ended up getting my first choice. I got Fort Lauderdale. Which was a phenomenal place to start.
Yep. What group were you in down there?
22. So we were the group that we had a kind of checkered past. We started out, I started out working for Mike Kane. It was a great first boss who loved to mock you. So we figured we were allowed to mock him. Wasn't so sure that worked out well. So started out there and he was our boss. And then I went through Louis Farrow ended up my boss, probably one of my closest, God rest his soul, one of my closest friends in the world. And I worked for him about three times throughout my agency time. And he was an NYPD guy, understood rabbi, which we call rabbis, the guys that sponsor us through our career. And every time that guy could help me, he went out of his way to help me. So just a phenomenal experience. Very young group. A lot of us had graduated within two or three classes of each other. I got to the class and interestingly in Fort Lauderdale, I walked in and pretty much everybody there at the time, with a few exceptions, was from the DC Baltimore area. Some, you know, Harry Summers, who ended up, you know, Harry ended up a SAC. We had gone to police academy together, hadn't seen each other in years, and he's there. And so I ended up working with guys I had gone to college with and all very young. And so we were all We were all crazy to be the best. And so we were competing for attention at night, whose deal was going to go, who could do the stupidest undercover assignment. So a really fascinating time. Sadly, later, after we had left, Rene Delacova took that group over. And that was the group he was in command of when he had gotten tied up in some extremely serious corruption, which was sad. It kind of ruined the name of Group 22, in my opinion. But great memories of those years.
Yeah, no, we thought bad about you guys down in Miami already. You didn't have to wait that long.
Yeah, no, I understand. Yeah, that was already there. So,
how did you pick, Snowcap? You just wanted to do something different?
You know, interesting. I'm not a big picture thinker, I guess. So I had become convinced that I needed language. I needed the Spanish language. And so before, when I was trying to get hired by DEA, I had gone to one-on-one language training on my own, paid for it to try to improve my language skills, knowing that that would help me. And then when I went, initially the SNOCAP program was you go to language training for SNOCAP, and then you do, I think, one 30 to 60 day deployment a year for 2 years, and you'd paid off your nut. So I thought that's a fair expectation. And I thought, sounds interesting. I'll go see, there's Jeff again. I want to see it at its base level. So I want to go see the plants, and I want to go see the rivers. And so I signed up for it and met some of guys that I stayed lifelong friends with. I was kind of a SNOCAP dropout. I ended up, after a ton of great training, on my first deployment, I was a riverine guy where we were supposedly doing, I always say it was just like clear and present danger, except completely different, without shootings and without, without real military guys that knew what they were doing. So here's a bunch of really basically ex-beat cops from the suburbs thrashing around the jungles in boats. And so I went down there, and the riverine program was struggling. They had, the boats would get sent in from the United States, and by the time they got to the Trinidad, Bolivia, there was nothing left on them because they'd all been stolen. So I ended up leaving after about a year in the program. And primarily what I did was a year of training. I trained with the SEALs. I trained with the Marines several times. And I think that was because our guys kept getting lost. They'd go down in the jungle, try land navigation stuff, and realize that they still didn't have the land navigation thing in triple canopy jungle aced. So they'd send us back to another 2 weeks land navigation class. So when my son went through TBS at Quantico as a Marine Corps officer, I said, listen, dude, I've been there. If you want to know where any of those ammo cans are, let me know, because I know where they all are. So, but a phenomenal time. But it was a really brief part of my career. But I did get to meet some 50 of the craziest guys who actually in the middle of a Panama land nav program where we were helicoptered out and dropped about, I would say probably 10 kilometers out and told, make your way back. And there's a opposing force waiting for you. Some of the guys said, we're not in any shape to walk this far. So they made their way to the nearest road and hired a taxi, took everybody's backpacks back in, came out, brought everybody back in and just said, we've aced this. This is the way DEA agents solve problems. We don't walk in the woods when there's taxis around. So the Army had probably just about had their fill of us by the time the end of that school. And these are all guys you worked with in Colombia, because I know who you worked with down there. I won't give their names, but I bet they were great at hailing a taxi.
Oh my God.
Absolutely. And overcome. And every time the Army would tell us, meet us outside, and it's pouring rain. It's friggin' Panama. It rains every day. We'd be inside and they'd come. They're used to troops being assigned there. And they would come scream at us about, why weren't you standing where we were? And we'd say, hey, Sarge, it's raining out there. And where we come from, if you have to get wet, you're going to get wet. But if you can wait where it's dry, see, it's only 10 feet over here. So those poor guys, they had no idea what they had signed those guys up. Yeah, they could not wait for us to get out of there.
Well, the old saying, I'm sure you've heard this before, is a good cop never gets cold, wet, or hungry.
That's right. That's exactly right. And we were pretty good at, I always say DEA agents were great at a lot of things. I mean, they were probably some of the most adaptive, smartest, and clearly the funniest people at the same time that you would ever meet. And that's when I recommend that job to young kids. I say, let me tell you something you don't know about that culture. But they understood, and I think one of the things that makes us marketable in the afterlife is we understood what a problem truly was. We didn't create problems to show we could handle it. If there was a problem and we could solve it by being more comfortable or less wet or fed, or maybe we start at 6 a.m. instead of 2 a.m. because it didn't matter, we were great at that. And I think that's why we were able to do our jobs for the years we did. And I hope that's what you found, because you had a much more illustrious career than I did. Think about my stories. It's about conning people and hailing cabs and playing tricks on executives.
But yeah, I think you're downplaying an awful lot right there, because South Florida back during that time, I got there in 87, you got there in 86. I mean, it was the Wild West.
It was. It certainly was. They used to say dope's falling from the sky, and that was absolutely true, because the airdrop technology and GPS wasn't very good. So dope truly was falling from the sky. And it was funny. We'd get these guys from up in like Minnesota or whatever DA offices, and they try to work a deal backwards to Florida because it was the Miami Vice days and they wanted to come down. So we would get these response requests. Hey, you got to help group so-and-so from Minneapolis. They're coming down. And we'd make bets on what they'd be wearing when they got there, because they'd watched Miami Vice and they'd come with the t-shirt and the blazer.
Yeah.
And they were just trying to blend in, and they'd show up and we're dressed like this. And we're like, dude, like, we don't really dress like that. So Miami Vice had a big impact on us those days. But yeah, it was a wonderful place to start a career.
It was. What was your next stop after Lauderdale?
I went to Quantico as an instructor for a little while after working 5 years of days and nights. It was like, let me try something different. And one of my curses, I think, is I get bored quickly and I want to do new. I want to try something new and learn something new. They were trying to get guys to come in as instructors. I'd only been on the job 5 years. So my thought was, really, am I going to be a reasonable instructor? So I went to the academy, got picked as an instructor. My kids were at an age, they were young, two young boys. I thought I'd spend some more time with my sons. And probably wasn't, I didn't look at it very well, because I got up there, and as soon as I got there, they stopped hiring. They went into a hiring freeze, which nobody knew was coming, of course. So they put us on the road to go do undercover program training, tactical training and stuff in the field. So I ended up on the road again, trying to be, a little season of time to be home. And I ended up gone most of the time. And actually, it was funny. I was in, I think it was Charleston, South Carolina. And I woke up one night, I had no idea where I was. And I wasn't a drinker, so I had no idea where I was. And I was like, we're doing city after city. So I'm clanging around looking for the light. And I grabbed the yellow pages that was in the bedstand at those days. And I look at it, I'm like, oh, I'm in Charleston. So I was always thankful that the right phone book was in there. But it ended up, I ended up running advanced and management training. And I think it was because I answered the phone. Dave Westrate was the supervisor or the SAC of training. And I had taught one program on kind of how agents should be handled after shootings. I spent a lot of time researching it. And what I learned was, in DEA, the expert is just the person in the room that knows the most about it. You don't have to have done every single thing. I used to say I could have probably taught how to land an airplane, even though I wasn't a pilot, just by researching it and saying I was a self-declared expert. So a lot of what I ended up teaching was based on researching and DEA giving me access to stuff. So I had a great experience at training, kind of learning what we needed to do. And years later, I went back as my final assignment to training. And part of the axe I had to grind was we need to change how we do things. We were doing things, we were using the same lesson plans from 1985 when I first got back there in 2010. So, but it was a great experience.
Yeah. And we're going to get into that a little bit. I meant to ask you, when you were still in Lauderdale, how much fun was it dealing with informants?
We, as the Xerox guy, as I often say, I didn't have any informants. Actually, it was phenomenal. And that's probably a part. One of the things I see in TV that just can't get it. They just can't capture the guy is your arch enemy on a Friday night, and you're tacking up and you're wearing all your kill equipment and you're going after this guy. And 5 minutes after you arrest him, he becomes almost your partner. And that, thinking back as an old man I am now, one, how treacherous that was, that we were trusting our lives to guys, especially you guys overseas. But it was probably one of the things that led to whatever success I had as an agent was I ended up with some great informants. I ended up with some guys that I really, even to the extent that we weren't supposed to, that I really liked. One of the guys I traveled through Central and South America on undercover deals with. And if he had turned on me, that would not have gone well for me. Cause despite what we see in TV and except for you black passport guys, we had no guns. You know, yeah. Me and Maria Ciociola did a job in Jamaica and our only weapon was a diving knife we found in our rental car.
Yeah.
So, you know, this idea that you got guys doing overwatch with 50 caliber rifles. So I think the informant piece was something that was really, I don't know that how you tell that story. And I think DEA has done a pretty good job of keeping the parts of that a secret that they should. But you're only as good as your human, right? Your human intelligence. You can intercept everyone's phones. You can have cameras on telephone poles, but unless you have somebody on the inside saying, this is what this guy's doing or what he's not doing. So that was a really fun part of the job. And the more experience you got, the better you were at converting that guy from public enemy number one, who you were swearing you were going to get no bail. And then you arrest him and he can help you. And you're like, I want to take this guy out forever. I don't want him to ever go to jail. And the prosecutors would look at you like you're just absolutely insane.
Well, it's funny because we'd arrest these guys and you'd tell them, you're not going to believe it now, but I'm going to end up being your best friend. Go get the hell away from me. I'm never going to
help you again. Exactly. Yeah. We had one that we had a guy who's he was a Bahamian guy and he had a pretty strong stutter. He was a good kid. He always wanted to be a pilot and he was flying loads. We captured him and he ended up flying some loads for us and helping us out. And it's interesting because he had a very distinctive voice. And one of my gifts as growing up with a crazy brother is I was pretty good at mimicking people. We can talk about some of the people I did later, but I would call people as him all the time and come up with deals and promise them deals. And they were convinced it was him. And he had a terrible stutter. He just struggled with a stutter, which I got into an airplane with him one time to taxi because he had brought dope back into the country. And once he touched the ground, we had to stay with him. And so we were taxiing across this airport. And he's on his microphone, not unlike the one you sent me, which thank you. I can now actually work for air traffic control.
But there you go. You look good too.
Thank you. I think I just look like I'm landing planes. Hold on. I got one taxiing, but with his headphones on, he didn't stutter at all. He spoke perfectly good. So, but there were some really good people that ended up informants that had made horrible life decisions. There were also some really dangerous, bad people that were working us at the same time we were working with them. So a fascinating part of the job that I don't think any other type of law enforcement is truly like that.
Right. And then from there, from Quantico, that's when you got promoted to first line supervisor, group supervisor.
It was. Went back to Florida. And most of my story in my career, I should have kept all my homes because my story is leaving places and going back to them throughout my life. So we were back to Florida, to Miami. And I was told later the career board had made a mistake. I was supposed to be going to Norfolk and Dan Anderson was supposed to be going back to Florida because he had been a plantation cop. He was in my group and that they had mixed it up. And initially they leaked it to everybody that I was going to Norfolk. So I hadn't told my wife, but I thought, yeah, Norfolk will be fun. I'm an ex-Virginia cop. And when it came out on the cable, I was going back to Florida and we hadn't had the most always positive experience in Florida. So I had to tell my wife, you know, deja vu all over again. We're going back, but that time I was in Miami proper, so I had gone to the major leagues, Steve. I had left the minor leagues of Fort Lauderdale, and now is in the major leagues of the Miami Field Division. So, but it was a great, great time.
Oh, I love Miami. It's still my favorite city in the United States. The same for my wife, but it's gotten so big, and the traffic is horrendous. There's no desire to ever live there again.
Yeah, totally agree. I had great assignments. I ran the Met team down there. I was thinking when you were talking, we may have met because I ended up on the Met desk, approving your budget request when you were doing Met stuff in Atlanta. And me and Frank Schroyer had that desk. And so that may have been where we got, and we approved everything. They should have never put us in charge of that. Any requests came in, we knew the guys were like, that sounds reasonable. Buy four cars for the Met program. Let's do it.
So. Well, my saving grace was I took over from Frankie. So he took care of
us. Oh, yeah.
You guys took care of us.
I modeled we had been classmates. So, and suite mates at the academy, which the statute of limitations hasn't run on any of that because there isn't one for what you see with Frankie. But I modeled my Met team when I took over a Met team in the field. I knew Frank and I copied everything. I never succeeded without copying. I flew to see him and said, I need to look at your Met team top to bottom. And Frank was good at programs like that. And so I stole everything I could steal from him, how he did it, what his timelines were. And we had a few laughs in the offing.
Oh, yeah. To get serious just a second here before we go any further, do you ever have any close calls where you or one of your agents was almost taken out?
I'd say there was some that caused the hair on the back of your neck stand out. I was on one. It ended up being a pretty funny story, but it wasn't initially. I was in the Dominican Republic, where I came back from yesterday on vacation, interestingly enough. The last time I was in the Dominican Republic, we had flown an airplane down, an aero commander down to show it to some cartel reps who were meeting us there. And so we flew into La Romana at Casa de Campo Airport there. And I was covered with me was a task force officer from Davie Police, Ron Marcico, great cop, who was assigned to our group. But again, no guns. We're overseas. And we had run it through the DOM rep office, gotten country clearance to come in, but it was very hush hush because we were meeting with these cartel guys. So we land, we go over and I meet him in the bar at the golf course, and we're going to show him this plane. And I look across the bar and there's John Oselick, an agent that we all knew. He was assigned to Santo Domingo at the time, and he had some what looked to be some local cops with him. So I thought, I'm in great shape. This is perfect. I'm covered. So we start talking, and it's time to go show him the plane. But before we do, and I'll mind you, I was still probably now just a GS9. And when I left the police department, I'd taken about a 50% pay cut, initial pay cut, to go to DEA, which many people do. My son just went through that with HSI. So we were poor as church mice. We say we're living on love, but that's not as filling as it could be. We would actually, after church, we would look through our seat cushions to see if we had enough change to buy two burgers or we had to split one. Good days. But so I was dressed like you would dress if you were a former cop and you were poor, like cheap sneakers. I had a Timex triathlon watch on. I just did not look like what my cover story was, which was I only spoke Australian accent when I was undercover. That's a story for another day. But so I'm here. I'm supposed to be the son of a Bahamian company family that owns charter aircraft, which gives me access to any airplane I need. And so I'm supposedly like a big deal. And here I am. I look terrible. So I'm at the table with the cartel guy, and he just keeps looking at me with this weird look in his face, which in law enforcement is not generally good. So I'm sitting there thinking, I don't think this guy's buying this story at all. So he stops me and he says, Jeffrey, and he had pretty good English language. You don't look like a millionaire. And I'm thinking, that's the truest words I've heard in a long time. So I thought, at least the guy's pretty observant. So he starts to kind of bow up on me like, I think this is a con job. So I decide the best defense sometimes is a strong offense. So I stand up in the bar and I said, deal's off. And he says, well, what is the problem? The typical walk away in negotiation. I said, look, you look really nice with your little Rolex and your cool little mesh looking shoes with no socks. I said, but you know what you look like to me? You look like a doper. I said, so when I'm not showing you my airplane, because the minute I do, they're going to know what we're doing. They're going to seize my $1 million airplane. So it's been nice talking to you, but, and then I basically told him to F off. So I'm thinking in the back of my head, not sure this is working. So, and I'm high and dry, except for John Oselick over in the corner. So, and really the job of your cover team is to arrest your murderer any way you look at it. So he keeps looking at me and he says, sit down. He's, Jeffrey, I like you. I like you, Jeffrey. I think, well, maybe I bought myself a little time. So he had rented a golf cart and it was sitting outside. So we go and we get in the golf cart and we're going to ride over to see the plane. And, so I get in the golf cart and there's an informant there. And then there's some guy that showed up with him who we didn't know who it was. I figured he was the torture chairman. So as soon as we start moving, he stops by a car and he gets that look again. Like, I don't think I believe who you are. So he opens the back of the car and there's a mirror with big Coke lines lined out.
Oh.
And they were beautiful Coke lines. I mean, it was obviously good Coke, which meant I'm working the right guy. That's the guy that's about to kill me is the right guy. So he looks at me and again, and he says, I am tired. We need to get a bump, Jeffrey. So I looked at him. I thought, I don't know what the line is for this one. So I'm starting to get a little hanked out. The informant's like elbowing me, like, this might be the time to bolt. So I'm thinking the car's here. I don't see Oslik, but I'm sure he's out there dressed as a bush following me. And so I tried it again because it worked before. And I said, deal's off. And he says, you with the deals off, like I'm driving this guy crazy. And I said, you're going to get all coked up. You're going to have powder coming out of your boogers. We're going to get over by my plane. They're going to realize you're coked up and they're going to seize my plane. I said, listen, I need you to send me a professional. I can't continue to work with you people. And so he just stares at me and I know what he's considering. He's considering, do I buy this again? So he slams the hatchback and he says, let's go seize your plane. So we go over to see the plane. I quickly show him the plane and it's a beautiful plane. Never are we ever going to send that nice plane to Colombia, right? As you know, the planes tended to change at delivery time to the Cessna 172 with a luggage rack, right? So we go over and see the plane. He loves it. They give us front money. We're going to go get 400 kilos in the coming month from him. And so they leave. And I said to the informant, I said, what was that all about? He goes, that guy was going to kill us. He goes, this is bad. So wasn't real close. So the funniest part of the thing, we get back and we fly back to San Juan where we spend the night. And I called John Oslik at Domrep and said, hey, John, awesome job of surveillance. I said, I saw you in the bar, but when we left and went to the parking lot and then went to the plane, I never saw you guys. So I don't know where you were. But I said, excellent job. And there was this long pause. And he said, we thought the meeting was over after the bar. We left. He said, nobody said anything about you showing an airplane. I'm like, what do you think we were doing there? Read the cable, John. So not only was I hinked out that this guy was going to whack me and throw my body in the car, but our cover had knocked off because it was getting late. And John had his couple of beers on government money and was heading back. But it ended up, and then so we went to San Juan and to unwind, me and the cop and the pilot, and we said, man, we got to go get some lunch. This is crazy. So I was still kind of hanked out. So we walk into a bar in San Juan, thought it was a restaurant. It's totally dark inside and sunny outside, and the door is shut behind us. The door's shut and it's pitch dark. And I'm trying to look around. A guy comes up and looks at us and we're the only Americans in there. And, you know, there were territorial Americans. Don't bow up on me. We're in Puerto Rico. I get the difference. But so the guy brings me a flower and looks at my guy I'm with and says, would you like to buy a flower for your date? And I said, no, not really. And he says, you'd like to buy. So all of a sudden these guys are standing up and Puerto Rico, in my mind, is one of the most treacherous places, San Juan in the world. So we end up running and we get away. So I got home and my wife says, and I didn't talk much about my trip, but she says, how'd the trip go? I said, went nice. It was really nice. It was a nice trip, lovely place. The water was pretty. But I said, listen, budget-wise, I need to buy a new watch. So because of my Timex triathlon. So I went and bought a dive watch. And every time I see that dive watch, I think, maybe you could have done that before the meeting with your Timex triathlon and your Nike sneakers.
Live and learn, right?
Yeah, there were other times, but that was the one where I just felt completely naked and out there and, you know, in a foreign country, unarmed with a blue passport and a fake name.
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, that happened way, way too often. And I don't know that it's any better now. I hope it is. But you look at what's going on in Mexico, they won't even let our agents carry weapons down there legally.
Crazy. Yeah, I go now places in my current consulting where I find myself and I think, I would have never come here while I was on the job without a gun. And here I am, you know, I, because I flew there, and it's so hard to fly with a gun when you're retired. It's like, what am I doing here? It's that same voice.
Yep, yep. You know, I don't, I probably shouldn't say this, but I don't carry a gun very often anymore. It's just the liability, the responsibility. I don't drink, so I don't worry about that, but it's just 38 years was long enough.
I do, and I think it's because I think my operating emotion in my life is generally being a scaredy cat. And my thought is, if I'm somewhere and something happens and I couldn't do anything about it, I would feel horrible. And I know my luck. The day I don't, I'll end up in the hotel takeover in India, right? That'll be me.
Well, hey, we're both in Florida. What could go wrong down here?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And there's so many retired cops down here. I always say in church, if somebody ever comes into our church and starts shooting it up, we're all going to shoot each other, because everybody around you in church is going to stand up with a gun in their hand. And the four real security guys there are going to shoot all of us. So.
I mean, it's serious, but
it's you're helpless. What are you going to do?
Right. So. And for our listeners there, you see us laughing about these serious events where he thought he was going to die out in the parking lot. It was, and it still continues to be a defense mechanism. It's not that we're just really stupid idiots out there that, and we might be, I don't know, but I'm not going to say that.
Yeah. I started to write a book down. It was going to be about the funny part of law enforcement. I believe the humor part. I always say it's really serious what we do or did, but we don't have to be serious while we're doing it. And I think the gallows humor that cops have, it's a little different with us. We tend to laugh about our contributions. We laugh about what the risk really was. And we find something funny in the story. You know, hours after 9/11, I'm making fun of my boss. Because we really needed to laugh, and laughing can be a reset. I think it can reset you too. Okay, this is what we really do, and sometimes that's hard for our wives and for our families to, you know, to figure out. We did a raid in Florida, and we were using Broward County guys. They had a crime scene unit, and they were sworn cops. And they had great surveillance vans. So we were working a big dope case. We knew there was a warehouse in Miami, and we would bring one of their van guys along, and he would video it. And he was a tech genius. So the video was always good, but he would call the ball on whatever was going on. And one of us would always be with him because he wasn't a task force officer and he didn't have the authority. So we're down in Miami all night long watching this warehouse, and I'm in the van with him, and we're in close, and everybody else is way out in their cars. And it's all these warehouses look exactly the same. And so we see, you know, and the dope was being brought in inside a cover load. So I don't remember what it was, but it had to be removed. And that's what the warehouse was going to be used for. So we decided, as long as people come, we're okay. The minute somebody leaves, we got to take it down. So guys keep coming and coming into these warehouses. And we kind of got a weird side view at this warehouse. So we're calling it out, and I'm like, oh, guys are leaving. So we make the decision to take it down. So I jump out of the van. You know, I'm kind of tacked up. We weren't really tacked up in those days. We'd have a vest that said police or DEA on it, you know, a goofy ass hat if we even had a hat. And that was to keep the sun off us. And a machine gun with as many rounds as we could carry that wouldn't drown us if we fell into a canal.
True.
So I go running into this warehouse, and I turn into the warehouse, and there's guys running everywhere, and there's stuff being dismantled, and it's pallets, and they had dismantled the pallets. So 3 steps into this warehouse, I stepped down, and a long nail from Honduras went up through my boot into my foot. And I became instantly convinced that I was stuck. And now here I am, I'm a mannequin, no cover, standing in the opening of this warehouse with a machine gun, not knowing who to aim it at. And they're running and screaming in dialects I'd never heard. And they're fortunately kind of running towards the back. And I know my team is right behind me. I know they're good guys. They're not going to leave me hanging. Well, they had turned into the wrong warehouse.
Oh,
so they had gone to one warehouse off of that one. And I hear all this screaming and yelling. I'm thinking, how many friggin' raids are going on out here? So I'm stuck, basically stuck. So I finally decided I'm going to pull my foot off this thing. And I basically wiped all the dirt from Honduras off into my foot. But what was interesting was while that was going on, one of our agents was involved in a shooting that was happening over the radio. So we couldn't get help where we needed. We had an agent shot and seriously injured. He ended up surviving not far from where we were. So it was a crazy time in Miami, but I remember thinking, you're alone in here and you're stuck on a nail. It was a big night, another big night.
Yeah. You know, and one thing you're seeing right now, ladies and gentlemen, is we tend to not take ourselves all that serious, because when you start believing all this crap that you're all that in a bag of chips, that's when you're really going to get hurt. Or surveillance goes to the wrong hair. Where
I was never all that. I worked with motivated people, and I look at what we did in those days, the number of search warrant activities we had in a week on homes where we would hit residence after residence after residence. And I'll say we did it well because we lived through it, but we had worked together a lot. We kind of knew what each other was going to do. We felt really well trained, but we would just do search warrant after search warrant after search warrant. And they're super, super dangerous. I mean, you're going into someone's home looking for them, and they've got the advantage. You know, you're running around and it's very difficult to do that safely. But thinking back on it, I did more search warrants and had more high risk entries as a DEA agent in the first 6 months that I was in Lauderdale as I did my entire time as a SWAT guy. So, and SWAT guys, you know, you're wearing everything that you could possibly buy from low bidder. So it was an interesting time. And then the idea of having a SWAT team do it for us was completely counter to our culture. If a police department said, we don't let you do our raids, our SWAT teams do them, we say, we don't work for you. We're federal agents. We do our own raids. And thinking back, we're like, maybe that wasn't the best thing, best choice. What did it matter? We could have told everybody at the bars that we did it, but why not let the guys with the tear gas do it, right?
Well, you know, the SWAT guys there with Miami-Dade, their academy was down from the old DEA officer in the
right. Center. Yep.
Those guys had arms on them as big as my waist. I'm thinking, those are the guys, I want them in here.
Well, our arms were that big. We just were in disguise, so we made them look smaller. Well, they were doing pull-ups while we were sitting in our cars watching to see if informants were cheating on us.
That's right. Jeff, we've been going for quite a while now, buddy. So Jeff has agreed to come on tomorrow's episode, everyone. So there's more stories. We haven't gotten into his headquarters career yet. And then what he's doing in life after DEA. So we're going to cover a lot more great topics. Appreciate you folks coming every week to join us here on the Game of Crimes. So come back tomorrow. You don't want to miss what's going to happen. In the meantime, God bless. Stay safe. We'll see you then.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.